Hello and welcome to Inside Education on 103.2 Dublin City FM. Every week, Inside Education brings you the best from the world of education from an Irish point of view. My name is Sean Delaney and you can listen to or download hundreds of podcasts of previous Inside Education editions on seandelaney.com/podcasts. This week I bring you the second part of my interview with Professor Bob Slaven from Johns Hopkins University, where he directs the Centre for Research and Reform in Education. I conducted the interview at the 2016 annual conference of the American Educational Research Association. Last week, Bob Slaven talked about cooperative learning and about the negative effects of ability grouping. The negative effects of ability grouping were that ethnic and linguistic minority children and economically poor children are overrepresented in lower achieving groups, and that once assigned to such a group, children tend to be left there. I noted that the drawbacks tended to be related to the negative effects of ability grouping on low achievers. So I proceeded to ask Bob Slaven if ability grouping had benefits for higher achievers.
Very few. That's a constant interest that people have had. And the studies that separate high achievers, middle achievers, low achievers usually find that it makes no difference for the high achievers, no difference for the middle achievers, and is detrimental to the low achievers. There are very few studies, even of programs for the gifted, that find a real benefit for the high achievers of being in an ability group situation. It doesn't hurt them to be ability group, but it doesn't help them. It kind of leaves you to wonder, well, why are we doing this if it's not beneficial to anybody?
Why might a school decide that they were still going to go ahead with it anyway?
The older the kids get and the further apart they get, there may be circumstances in which the school says, it's okay, well, it's just impossible. And I will say that the research on ability grouping is mostly in middle school rather than in senior high school. And then, of course, in elementary school or primary school, there's a lot of research, but it's usually on things that are done within classrooms rather than across classrooms, because that's the pattern there. Once you're in senior high school, then it may just, as a pragmatic issue, there may be kids who are just too far apart and you have to do something about it. Particularly in mathematics. I think that may be where the problem is greatest. And the reason mathematics is because mathematics is very step-by-step, and it depends, you know, the success at this level depends a lot on whether you've got the prerequisites from the previous level, so that the students lack those prerequisites, then they may be in big trouble. If you have to group, or if you have to attend to those big differences, you've got to, as educators, be thinking, okay, how do we accelerate gains for those low-achieving kids? It's not just the fact that they're put into a separate group is definitely not going to help them. But if that group is very small, if it gets additional time, I mean, there's been some research on double dose, or, you know, where you get twice the amount of time in math or whatever the subject may be, where they're getting one-to-one or very small group instruction at some certain points during the week, things of that kind that are intended to do far more to accelerate you into the middle, rather than expecting that just because we've put you in a given room that room will somehow produce better outcomes. It definitely will not.
So if we go back then to the problem that we started with, and that is the fact that there's the heterogeneity of the average classroom, that there are children with all levels of achievement. How can teachers respond to those differences without grouping?
I think that the answer is, you know, you need to be aware of where the students are and to use things that help students with the specific problem that they're having. So as I was talking about earlier, if you have heterogeneous teams in a cooperative learning setting, the teacher can come around, visit with the different teams, and make sure that Johnny, struggling in this subject, is on track. And if not, perhaps pull him aside, or perhaps pull him aside with a couple of other kids and give him some additional instruction on that specific thing that they're having difficulty with. And then, you know, have them then rejoin their team and, you know, continue along with them. Things of that kind that don't, you know, put a different label on the kid, but that provide the specific thing that's holding them up. So that, you know, if your difficulty in learning decimals is due to the fact that you never really understood fractions, then you can, you know, say, okay, well, let's do a little review of fractions and tenths and hundredths that perhaps not the entire class needs, but these particular kids do need it. Then you find a time to review with them so that they get ahead. If you see your task as a teacher along those lines rather than along the lines of how do we group these kids to kind of get them out of our way or to, you know, have a whole class that's taught at a lower level, all the kids are going to be held accountable ultimately for the same learning. They're all going to be assessed at some point in terms of their learning. They have to be exposed to the whole of the curriculum. It's just a question of, do you just write off a certain proportion of them, or do you say, well, these kids are going to need some additional help or different strategies or what have you to get to that standard, but we're not giving up on them in advance by just saying, well, we're going to teach them less than we teach the other kids.
You said that you could see possibly a case for ability grouping at a senior high school, but you said most of the research was in elementary and middle school grades. Can you see any situation in which ability grouping could legitimately be justified in middle or elementary school?
I think not. Again, the evidence is at least zero or negative, depending on which kids you're talking about. I don't see a rationale for grouping at those levels. I'm not sure I see a rationale at the high school level. It's just not studied at the high school level, hardly at all. But and it gets more complicated at the high school because, you know, you know that there are some kids who are preparing to go to college and there's some kids who are preparing to go to trade school. And so the different needs come out. Whereas up through the end of middle school, pretty much the expectations are the same. You know, you're not telling a seventh grader that, oh, no, you're never going to college. But in an 11th grader, you may say, okay, listen, you can be very wealthy as a bricklayer or as a plumber. You know, depending on what the system is, it may not be foolish to say, okay, you know, we're going to make some different decisions. But even there, it's not ability grouping per se that you're doing. It's different curricula that lead to different places. You know, you may wonder, if you're headed toward being a very successful plumber, do you need calculus? You don't. Maybe nobody does. But, you know, it becomes that kind of question rather than a question of, are you in Math 8 high, Math 8 middle, or Math 8 low? There's probably no rationale for that if Math 8 is the expectation for everyone. But there may be when you're at the very end point of senior high school.
A particular kind of heterogeneity we have in Irish schools is multi-grade classes. Mm. Is that something you've looked at all in your research?
Now, when you say multi-grade, you mean
You might have, say, first, second, and third grade, or we call them first, second, and third class in one classroom together. So you have, say, 7, 8, and 9-year-olds.
But it's not because they're little, tiny, isolated rural places. You're doing it explicitly you want them to be.
Well, no, I was actually thinking of because they were rural places.
Oh, okay.
I mean, it can occasionally happen in a bigger school, maybe just because you have a lot of children, maybe in fifth class and fewer in sixth and fourth,
yeah.
So you might split some of your fifth class between the fourth and the sixth class.
Right. There was a time when it was very popular to have multi-grade classes, even in situations where you didn't have to. And in the process of reviewing that, I became aware of the literature on what you're talking about, which is situations where you have multiple grades and or you have too many fifth graders and not enough sixth graders and you move some across. And it doesn't seem to make any difference. You know, I don't think it's either beneficial or detrimental. In general, I think that one of the things that you learn from looking at research on classroom organization generally is that the quality of teaching is so much more important than the grouping. That's where the focus needs to be. The quality and techniques for teaching are vastly more important. And if you're a very capable teacher teaching a mixed class, you know, then I'm sure that there's no particular reason you wouldn't expect those kids to excel. It adds a dimension of difficulty, no question. You know, and you'd make some accommodation to it because if you have first, second, and third grade kids in the same class, you know, they're learning different things. I mean, the objectives are different, so you may need to take them aside. You'd be well advised to use third graders as peer tutors for the younger children, and, you know, things of that kind that I think would come to mind. But at the end of the day, I think that it would be that a wise and capable teacher would be able to make the outcomes be just as good or maybe better.
You mentioned that there was a time when it was a bit of a fashion to have multi-grade classes in schools where it wasn't necessary. Has that fashion ended?
I haven't heard about it for quite a while, but it was maybe the 80s, really quite a while ago, but it was quite popular at that time. There was something called the open classroom that was related to it, and the multi-age classroom was just something that very innovative places were trying at that time. Okay. And it didn't make much difference either.
Okay. You chair the Success for All Foundation. Can you say what that is?
It is a nonprofit organization that developed and disseminates, researches a program called Success for All, and as well as a number of other programs too, by the way, but most known for its Success for All program, which is a program for trying to transform entire schools, almost entirely schools serving very disadvantaged children. So what we've developed is a strategy to go into very disadvantaged, mostly elementary schools, to a lesser extent middle schools, where you know from the history that the great majority of children are headed for very bad futures, and saying from the outset, okay, this is just not going to happen anymore. We're going to use proven instructional strategies for teachers at each grade level. We're going to use materials that make sure the kids are going to be successful, particularly in reading. It's the main focus, though we have math programs as well. We're going to constantly assess children to make sure that they are not forgotten, that if they're headed for trouble, that we're going to rescue them right now rather than let them fall far behind. We have a computer-assisted tutoring model that can be used either individually or in a small group to help children who are falling behind, so we can bring them up to grade level right away before they even know they're in trouble. There's a lot of emphasis on parent involvement. We have all sorts of things to engage parents, to support children's success in terms of what the parents do with their kids at home, and things that they can do in the school, and to deal with issues like children who are not attending school, or who are late a lot, or children who are homeless, or children who are having very serious behavior difficulties, or big problems at home, or things of that kind. In a way, it was designed where, you know, we, many years ago, just kind of sat down and said, what are all the ways in which children can fail, and how do we make sure that none of those things happen? And what are all the ways in which children can succeed, and how do we make sure that those things happen? And that really is all it is, you know, I think just about anybody sitting down with those objectives would probably come up with something fairly similar, because if you say every child has to succeed, how could you not have a tutoring program? How could you not deal with attendance? How could you not deal with behavior? How could you not provide teachers with extensive professional development and proven strategies? All of those things are, you know, would have to come to mind to say, you know, if you're going to design a school to be sure that everybody was going to succeed.
Are those strategies that you've put in place, are they put in place by the teachers in the school, or is it somebody from outside who comes into the school to support the work that's already going on in the school?
What we do at the beginning, and this is important, we present the project to the whole staff, let them ask questions, ideally send a delegation to visit a school that's already using the program, really, you know, research it as well as they can, and eventually come back and vote. And at least 80% of the teachers need to vote in favor. So then we know that we're going in with some, at least willingness to give it a good try. And then our staff comes in and provides professional development for the whole staff, adapted to the needs, depending if you're a kindergarten teacher or a sixth grade teacher, whatever you are. The school has a facilitator who is an experienced teacher from the school's own staff, usually, who works with all of the teachers to make sure that they're all, you know, doing a good job and on track, and they're getting the materials they need. Helps with the process of keeping track of the data of where, you know, where all the children are. We have a whole system of computerized data management to be sure that all the children are on track, to set up family support team within the school that deals with all these issues that go beyond the classroom, deal with, you know, family issues and attendance issues and behavior issues, things of that kind. And then our staff comes back to visit in the first year about once a month. In the second year, it's less than that, and, you know, kind of reduce, but never to zero. So we, you know, we stay in close connection with the schools really forever, but it becomes, you know, less often than in the very first year. So over time, you know, the facilitator begins to take on a lot of the functions that we might have fulfilled. The principal is, of course, learning how to manage this. We have a whole system for training of principals, training of facilitators, and distributed leadership. You know, we have different teams that deal with various aspects of the program that the teachers participate in and that the facilitator, you know, is always a member of, but tries to pass off leadership to the various teachers. So it's quite a complex approach. But again, it's what you would do if you're saying enough is enough, that it's time to get serious about all children succeeding in this process.
And is there a mechanism whereby you can allocate any extra staffing to any of the schools, or are all those tasks you've named, they're all done by existing staff in the school?
They're almost always done by existing staff. I mean, we usually can reallocate staff who's already there. In the U.S., we work with Title I schools. So high poverty schools would typically receive quite a lot of money from the federal government called Title I. And so what they're doing is they're reallocating their Title I funding primarily to this activity. And that means in the past that mostly supports staff. So we're taking the staff that's supported by Title I and giving them different titles, perhaps, and certainly very different functions. And that's where the facilitator comes from. And tutors are likely to be teacher's aides or paraprofessionals who'd been paid for by Title I. So we work with about 1,000 schools in the U.S. We work with about 130 in the U.K., or in mostly England and Wales. They have a different structure where they've got a pupil premium money that comes based on poverty, a little bit like Title I. And that money would be allocated in a different way. And they tend to have a lot of paraprofessionals in their schools so that, we can make use of them as tutors. So it's different. But in a way, we look at a school and say, okay, the resources are here somewhere. And let's find a way to make them more effective rather than, going and getting a lot of additional resources.
And you mentioned there that one of the groups of children that could be at risk are those who are homeless. What kind of barriers or difficulties do they face in particular, and how can you support them through your work?
Homeless kids, I mean, as a total proportion, that's not that large. Their problems are very extreme and very particular to where they happen to be. So I can't tell you an overall solution. The point is, though, that the school has a capacity, it has to try to figure out what's the best way to help with this child, with the parent or parents in their very difficult circumstance that they face. And one closely related problem is mobility. There, children who move around a lot, and so sometimes we help the schools to enable kids who are moving around a lot to stay in the same school, even if they no longer live in that catchment area, to keep something consistent in their lives. And with homeless kids as well, a lot of homeless kids go in and out of shelters, or they have very, very disorganized lives. And we want both, as much as possible, the parents, but certainly the children, to have as stable a life as is possible, given the realities that they have to face.
Have you evaluated the success of Success for All?
Oh, many times. There are something like 50 studies, mostly done by people other than ourselves, that have evaluated the impact of the program. So not every single one of them has found positive impacts, but almost every one of them. It's a very powerful program. And some of these studies have been large, randomized, third-party experiments that find, quite substantial impacts on students. And one study followed the kids for several years after the program was over and found that they were maintaining the gains that they had achieved, and that they were, most importantly, staying out of special education and not being retained at substantially different rates than a control group.
And as chair, is your vision for the future of it to keep expanding it, or is it to tweak it and to improve it, or is it a combination of both?
Yeah, it's both. We're constantly improving and adding in new elements. partly in response to things that change in the environment. So, for example, we have to change our materials to be consistent with the Common Core or to other changes that take place in standards and expectations. We've done a lot to add in technology and use technology to make this computer-assisted tutoring model that makes it much more cost-effective to provide tutoring. I don't know, many, many other changes in light of what we learn from the schools. We're constantly studying our own schools and getting feedback from them. And so, you know, we modify the program in light of that.
Another area of interest for you is evidence-based education. And my question is, to what extent do you think policy and practice, but if we take policy first, to what extent is policy guided by research?
It's not. It really is not.
Or why is that?
I don't completely understand it, but I think that there are several things that are at work. There was a state superintendent who once gave a speech to people who had funded projects in the Institute for Education Sciences. So these were education researchers, and they brought in a state superintendent from one of our biggest states to speak to them about the importance of research. And he was supposed to say, "You guys are great." And he said, and I'm certain that he was not being ironic or funny, he said, "My definition of good research is that which confirms what I always believed. And bad research is that which disconfirms that which I've always believed." I think a lot of people, you know, have that kind of a view, is that they've always believed that ability grouping is good or it's bad, or, you know, whatever method is good or it's bad. And then they go and look for research that supports their view, and they ignore research that doesn't support their view. So research plays a certain role, but it's sort of honored in the breach of observance. So it doesn't really greatly influence what people really do, but sort of serves as a nice wrapper for policies that didn't come about because of the research. Partly, I think that that has to do with the fact that until fairly recently, the research that people had available was pretty squishy. And still, if you walk around at this conference, 90% of the stuff that you'll hear is still pretty squishy. You know,
what do you mean squishy?
Well, in the sense that it's somebody's opinion that's dressed up with some numbers. You know, it's very kind of theoretical and not really that down to earth. The research was carried out under a circumstance very different from ordinary teaching practice. Here's an example. I heard a paper a couple days ago that somebody was presenting, and there was some program that had three big components to it. And they were comparing the gains that were made by kids whose teachers used all three components, or two components, or one component, or no components. And as you might imagine, the ones who used the most components got the best. What she wasn't dealing with was, well, of course they would, because the teachers themselves chose how many of these components to implement. So the teachers who could implement the three components were probably better teachers. The ones who implemented zero components might have been teachers who were struggling to be able to teach at all, or not. Maybe it's the most wonderful program that ever existed, but that's squishy research. And it causes fights among researchers, and people on the outside of research, or even at this conference, you know, say, well, let them fight it out. I don't really know. I don't understand research well enough, and I don't really care. And everybody's got a different opinion. And if your researcher says this, I'll go get a researcher who'll say the opposite. And I think people just, you know, have discounted the value of research because of those kinds of, you know, perceptions that people always find what they expected to find, and that they don't get the total truth, and that, you know, that the research itself is not of such high value. Now, in the last 10, 15 years, the Department of Education has been supporting a lot of very large, randomized, very pristine studies whose results will not go away. I mean, they are very solid. And the world at large doesn't all believe in them, or isn't always aware that these things even exist. But a larger and larger number of people in the policy world, not just in the world of research, are coming to understand those are different. This is not the same case. These are things you can really hang your hat on, the things that are likely to replicate and to really make a difference at scale. You know, because these are always large experiments involving many different districts, many different schools, and when you find a positive impact in studies of that kind, which is hard to do, but when it does come through, people know this is no longer just, you know, academics being academics. This is really for serious. In a way, it's more like the situation of where economists look at doing this versus that, and they've got real evidence. This is, you know, they've done randomized experiments in which whole states have done this versus that over a period of a couple years, and they've got, you know, the evidence is really very strong that this would be better than the other thing. It doesn't mean they always prevail, but we're getting to the point where we're behaving like those economists or like medical researchers that also do very large randomized experiments, or like agriculture, where people do very large experiments, you know, doing one kind of thing or another, in which the connection between research and practice is much closer because the policymakers, especially the central policymakers, are beginning to have trust in the outcomes of these studies. When they understand that, you know, that this was a study of this kind, that's something to sit up and take notice at.
So is that bad news for people who engage in qualitative research and who want to impact on policy?
If they want to influence policy, the qualitative research is important. It shouldn't ever be used to determine whether something is successful or not. But what qualitative research can do and should do is to inform people about what the hell happened. You know, what characterized the intervention in the first place? So a qualitative researcher, first off, may go out and find out what's going on to inform people who are creating interventions. But once the intervention is actually being evaluated, they go out, they observe things going on, they do interviews, they give you a much better sense about what happened. So you don't just get to the end and you say, well, it worked. And you say, what was it? I don't know. You know, but whatever it was, it worked. You know, you want research that will inform you at a more deep level about what actually happened, but that's not sufficient in itself. Certainly not when you're looking at something like achievement that's easily measured, and that in education is generally, at the policy level, what people are after.
And that's the view of Professor Bob Slavin from Johns Hopkins University, who spoke to me at the annual meeting of the American Educational Research Association, which was held in Washington, D.C. in April. If you like what you heard on today's programme, please tell your friends about it by sharing links to the programme on social media. You can get in touch with the programme by emailing feedback or suggestions to insidededucation@dublincityfm.ie. Until the same time next week, this is Sean Delaney signing off. Thank you for listening.